Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Rear Vision with me, Annabelle Quince. This week, the second part of our look at the history behind the current tension between Iran and the West over Iran's nuclear industry.
Iran remains the world's primary state sponsor of terror, pursuing nuclear weapons while depriving its people of the freedom they seek and deserve.
President Bush warned that letting Iran acquire nuclear weapons would put the Middle East, quote, under the shadow of a nuclear holocaust.
The French foreign minister has put the international spotlight on Iran's nuclear program with his dire warning. We have to prepare for the worst, said Bernard Kouchner, and the worst is war.
Iran's president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has arrived in New York, ready to tell the United Nations that his country's nuclear ambitions are purely peaceful.
We don't need the bomb. For 28 years, we have defended ourselves in the face of enemy onslaughts. Every day, we are becoming more powerful.
Today, a program that first went to air last year and which focuses on how and why Iran's nuclear industry has developed. And on the United States' determination to stop it. Debate over Iran's nuclear industry has raged across the globe for almost a decade and has come to a head in the past 3 years with the United Nations threatening sanctions against Iran if it didn't open its facilities to international inspections, something that it has now agreed to do. Iran has always claimed that it is not interested in nuclear weapons and is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Despite this, the Western world has remained sceptical of Iran's motives for pursuing nuclear technology. The story of Iran's interest in nuclear technology goes back to the 1950s. Iran was then being led by the young Shah, who had been installed in power in 1953 after a CIA-led coup against the elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh. The then US President, Dwight Eisenhower, who had sanctioned the coup, introduced a program called Atoms for Peace. Mohammad Saini is Professor and Chairman of Chemical and Petroleum Engineering at the University of Southern California.
In the late 1950s, the administration of President Dwight Eisenhower developed a program called Atoms for Peace, by which the United States intended to share its nuclear technology with developing countries like Iran for peaceful use of nuclear energy. At that time, the government of Shah of Iran and the U.S. administration signed a treaty by which the U.S. would help Iran to set up a nuclear program. Then in the 1960s, the United States sold Iran a research nuclear reactor, a 5-megawatt reactor, that was installed at Tehran Nuclear Research Center, housed in Tehran University. That was in 1967, and that's how Iran's nuclear program actually started.
It was 2 decades till the program took off, with the assistance of a number of people who are now senior figures in the Bush administration.
The drive for Iran's nuclear program did not actually start before 1973, when we had the Arab-Israeli war. After that war, the oil price went up dramatically, and therefore Iran's income from its oil export increased dramatically. At that time, the Shah of Iran declared that oil was too expensive and too good to just burn it to generate energy, and he wanted to look for other types of energy sources. And right after that, the United States started talking to the Shah through U.S. Ambassador in Tehran, Richard Helms, persuading him to go after nuclear energy. But the main driving force behind the program was actually the administration of Henry Kissinger and also Donald Rumsfeld, the present Defense Secretary, Dick Cheney, the present Vice President, who was Chief of Staff at that time, and even Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Deputy Secretary of Defense a couple of years ago. They all played a role in persuading the Shah of Iran to go after nuclear energy.
What was to be gained on both sides? What was Iran hoping to get out of nuclear energy? What did they want to do with it? And what did America gain? Why were they trying to push a nuclear industry onto Iran?
Well, for Iran, it would allow it to export oil and not burn oil domestically to generate energy. And at the same time, for the U.S., since the price of oil had gone up and the United States was spending a lot more money to import oil, it would have been very beneficial to the U.S. economy to develop a huge market for its nuclear industry in Iran, because Iran and the United States signed an agreement by which Iran would buy 8 nuclear reactors worth $15 billion. And remember, we are talking about $15 billion 30 years ago, which means a lot more in present dollars.
But did the Shah of Iran intend to develop a nuclear weapons program?
Since the Shah of Iran was a close ally of the United States, the United States did not mind if the Shah even went after nuclear weapon. In fact, the Shah did declare at some point that Iran was going to develop a nuclear weapon. And there are documents that indicate that the Shah of Iran was secretly doing some research on how to use plutonium to make a nuclear bomb. And the U.S. actually was aware of it, but did not protest or mind at that time.
Bennett Ramberg served in the State Department under the first President Bush and argues that the U.S. didn't know about the Shah's nuclear weapons program.
Just before the Shah fell, he had created a small group to investigate the possibility of pursuing a nuclear weapons program, and this was done secretly. And he had acquired some technology that would facilitate that, laser enrichment technology, for example. But his regime was overthrown, and that ambition, of course, ended with that at that time.
Was that something that the United States knew about at all?
I'm not certain if the United States knew. Clearly, there ought to have been questions about why he wanted certain technologies. For example, this laser technology, which is at the time was a rather sophisticated technology. But I haven't seen any reference to the fact that the United States was privy to the desires of the Shah to go forward with a nuclear weapons program.
The unthinkable has finally happened. The Shah of Iran has left. Just 12 hours ago, in freezing temperatures, the 59-year-old Shah of Iran walked aboard his Boeing jet and, with tears streaming down his face, finally left the country he'd dominated for 37 years.
His home, Ayatollah Khomeini, the 78-year-old opposition leader who has inspired a nation and toppled a 2,000-year-old monarchy, has set foot again on his native soil for the first time for nearly 50 years.
After the Iranian Revolution, the first revolutionary government of Iran and their Prime Minister Mehdi Bazargan decided that Iran really didn't need nuclear reactors and nuclear energy, given all the other problems that Iran had to deal with. And therefore, they canceled the agreement that they had signed with the United States regarding buying 8 nuclear reactors, and they greatly limited Iran's nuclear research program. But the fact is, after Iran-Iraq war started and Iran found itself isolated, Iran decided to go back and look at the nuclear program that the Shah had started.
So was it because they felt threatened by Iraq and the fact that Iraq was itself developing some kind of nuclear weapons, or was it they suddenly saw the need for nuclear power again?
You have to remember that in 1981, the Israeli Air Force bombed Iraq nuclear reactor in Osirak and destroyed it. That, in some sense, gave Iran a warning that Iraq is there after nuclear bomb. At the same time, as I mentioned, during the Iran-Iraq war, especially the first few years, Iran was totally isolated and no country was willing to sell Iran any weapons, at least advanced weapons. And given that Iraq has invaded Iran and had occupied a large chunk of Iranian territory in south and southwestern part of the country, it is completely reasonable to think that security aspect played an important role in the thinking of Iranian government when it decided to restart Iran's nuclear program. I'm not saying that that was the only reason, but what I'm saying is that it is totally reasonable to think that that was at least one of the reasons that they considered when they decided to restart the program.
Iran's attempts to revitalize its nuclear program were frustrated by United States sanctions. The distrust had begun with the overthrow of the Shah and intensified with the Iran hostage crisis, when for 444 days, 66 U.S. citizens were held hostage in Tehran.
When the student entered the American embassy...
Well, the event that the United States has always feared in Iran has now taken place. 400 armed students have taken over the U.S. embassy and are holding diplomats hostage.
They waited and waited. It was raining...
The Ayatollah Khomeini has stated there'll be no talks without the Shah being returned to Iran.
The regime defined itself as a revolutionary regime with great antipathy towards the United States, and the United States was not willing to deal with such a regime, and the leverage it had, other than the sanctions it put in preventing American companies from doing commerce with Iran, were imposed, and Iran's support for terrorist activities in the region also soured relations further.
So, if not to the U.S., where did the new Iranian government go to try and re-establish its nuclear program?
What they did first was to go after Germany, West Germany at that time, in order to persuade them to come back to Iran and finish construction of two nuclear reactors in Bushehr, the site of Iran's present nuclear reactor by Persian Gulf. When Germany did not agree to do that, they tried to get other countries to come in and complete the project. They tried Czechoslovakia, they tried Argentina, and they tried to get some parts of the reactor from Poland, from Italy. And in each case, the United States actually prevented it, which I believe was a big mistake, because if the Western countries at that time had gone back to Iran and had completed Iran's nuclear reactors in Bushehr and perhaps subsequent reactors, they would have had a big say in how those reactors would be run, and they would have had control on nuclear fuel for those reactors and also nuclear fuel waste.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has stated that Iran probably gained assistance from some unknown source. One suggestion is that it came illegally from Pakistan.
It appears that Iran acquired enrichment technology from Pakistan. I think in the documentation provided by the International Atomic Energy Agency, they refer to the fact that it acquired enrichment technology from an undisclosed source. I don't believe it's specified in the documentation. I may be incorrect, though, that Pakistan was the provider. The agency has conferred with Pakistan. Whether this is done totally or solely through the Khan network or otherwise, a little uncertain in my mind, but clearly Pakistan was involved in acquiring the centrifuge is designed to allow Iran to generate enriched uranium for, they allege, a peaceful program. The Russians stepped in the mid-90s, and they indicated that they would be willing to finance a reactor at Bushehr, and the reactor construction began. And every year for the past several years, it's been declared that the reactor construction is near completion or will be complete. And again this year, it's been declared that reactor operations, or at least the fuel, could be provided by the fall, that is the fall of 2006, and reoperations could begin or commence shortly thereafter. So this is the state of the program. The Iranian government has declared that they want to develop or acquire another 19 or so reactors in the decades to come. It takes roughly a decade to build a nuclear power plant. It could be done in a shorter time. And if you build multiple plants at one time, it would be an economy of scale, presumably, in doing so. And the Iranians have declared that they want to build up to 20 reactors or have 20 reactors in operation in the years to come.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, I'm taking a look at the history of Iran's nuclear industry. Iran, unlike India, Pakistan or Israel, did ratify the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970 and is therefore required to keep the International Atomic Energy Agency informed of all its nuclear facilities. But in 2002, an Iranian opposition group based in London revealed the existence of two previously unknown facilities. The revelation has thrown into question just how open the Iranian government has been.
Well, it was a stunning revelation. Apparently, had never been disclosed before that the Iranians had these enrichment facilities. They were supposed to be provided, that is, the information pertaining to these facilities to the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is part of a what's called a safeguards agreement between the agency and Iran. And the agency learned about it as a result of the revelations provided by an Iranian dissident group in London that these facilities existed. And the agencies queried the Iranians and said, can you establish whether this allegation is true or not? And given the detail provided by the dissident agencies, the International Atomic Energy Agency demanded the right to inspect the sites, and the Iranians reluctantly allowed this. And it was revealed that they had an enrichment site in preparation to generate high-enriched uranium, although the centrifuges themselves were not in place, nor were they generating any enriched uranium, or at least any substantial quantities.
The fact that Iran did not declare the Natanz facility or the Arak facility to International Atomic Energy Agency for so long was not a violation of its legal obligation towards the NPT agreement. The NPT agreement and its safeguard stipulate that if a country which is a member of NPT builds nuclear facilities, it is only obligated to report the existence of the facilities 180 days before any nuclear materials are introduced into the facilities. So that means that member states are not under any obligation to report construction of nuclear facilities. Of course, if they report it, that would create more trust between the agency and the aspiring nation, which is trying to set up a nuclear industry or nuclear facility. But if they don't, it does not represent any violation of their obligation towards NPT agreement. At the same time, I don't believe, as I pointed out in one of my articles, I don't believe if Iran had actually declared its intention back in 1985 that they want to set up extensive facilities for complete nuclear fuel cycle, the West would have rushed to help them. I believe they would have done whatever they could to prevent Iran from actually developing and constructing the facility. So I don't think that Iran could have circumvented the criticism that it is receiving now if it had declared many, many years ago its intention and what it planned to do.
The Iranians have long argued that despite their vast oil and gas reserves, they actually need a nuclear industry for power generation.
I became interested several years ago in the question of whether Iran needs an alternative source of energy, given that it has vast reserves of oil and gas. And my conclusion was that because Iran exports oil and because oil exports make a big chunk of Iran's foreign currency earning, about 80% of it, it makes perfect sense for Iran to look for alternative sources of energy and not burn oil in Iran in order to generate electricity. And at the same time, we all know that burning oil produces a lot of pollution. Iran has been suffering greatly. The air is polluted. The groundwater resources in Iran are vastly polluted. So if you look at it from many different angles, it makes sense for Iran to go after an alternative source of energy other than oil and gas.
Even if Iran does need nuclear power, does it need to enrich its own uranium?
Well, there doesn't seem to be any economic justification for the enrichment program, which would provide fuel for reactors at this point in time. To justify that, the Iranians would need about 20 reactors. They don't have at this time one commercial reactor in operation. That reactor, which is may commence operating this year, may or may not, is a Russian-supplied reactor located on the Persian Gulf called the Bushehr reactor. And there would be nothing to justify from an economic point of view the fuel cycle programs which they've demanded allowance for. So this does raise serious apprehensions in my mind of what their objectives are. In the long term, for energy independence, it would be desirable that they have these facilities. But again, at this point in time, for years to come, there would be no justification for this.
If Iran has its own domestic nuclear industry that can produce enriched uranium, even if it doesn't want to use it for any illicit use or any illegal production of nuclear weapon, it does give it prestige, it does give it influence in the Middle East. So when Iran has developed all the know-how and technology in Iran and has the facility or completing the facility for setting up uranium enrichment program and has the uranium mine in Iran that provides uranium ore, it is logical for Iran to try to have its own uranium enrichment program. And of course, the main worry about the program is that the same program that can be used to generate nuclear fuel for nuclear reactors can also be used for making nuclear weapons. So if there were trust between Iran and, let's say, Western Europe, maybe we could address that question in a more agreeable way. But in the absence of that trust, Iran doesn't trust the West because it doesn't trust the fact that if it develops a network of nuclear reactor, they will be actually willing to provide Iran with enriched uranium for the reactor.
The dispute over Iran's suspect nuclear program has dominated the first 24 hours of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Mr. President.
The UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan's opening address urged Iran to give up the nuclear technology that could result in bomb-making. And Germany's Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer warned Tehran if it insists on beginning the reprocessing of nuclear fuel, it could result in the complete breakdown of talks with the EU and a referral to the UN Security Council in the first step towards sanctions. But Iran's Foreign Minister Kamal Karazi dismissed the suspicions and censure, saying Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty guarantees non-nuclear armed states the right to peaceful nuclear technology, and said Iran is determined to carry out uranium enrichment.
Iran, for its part, is determined to pursue all legal areas of nuclear technology, including enrichment, exclusively for peaceful purposes.
Israel, Pakistan, and India have all developed nuclear weapons and have not signed the NPT, yet all receive support from the United States. So is the US using a double standard when it's dealing with Iran?
Oh, there is no question. Not only there is a sense, a very strong sense in Iran that there is a double standard. I mean, the non-aligned countries can see it. I would like to emphasize this point, that the most dangerous nuclear country in the world is Pakistan. This is a country which is run by its military, a military that has a lot of radical Islamist elements. This is the same military that literally created Taliban, that took power in Afghanistan and provided a refuge for Osama bin Laden. And at the same time, for example, the United States has offered India advanced nuclear technology. Israel, as you pointed out, is not even a member of NPT or its safeguard agreements. And it is widely known and widely believed in the West that it has a very powerful and very extensive nuclear arsenal and other weapons of mass destruction. The only thing that the United States has offered Iran has been threat and sanctions. So there is no question that we have very severe double standards here.
Well, in the Iranian case, they've declared that the program is totally, absolutely, for peaceful purposes. And they are a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which went into force in 1970. And as a consequence, they're subject to the requirements of that agreement. The other three countries that you mentioned never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. All three of those countries have actually developed nuclear weapons. So the Iranians are stuck on their own petard, meaning that they agree that the program is totally for peaceful purposes. They have an obligation under the treaty to provide total transparency, and they failed to do so for 18 years.
According to Fred Halliday, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics, the current crisis over Iran's nuclear industry has a lot to do with the battle between Iran and the US for control over West Asia.
The United States and Iran have been engaged in a major conflict across West Asia for over 25 years, since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And now the focus is Iraq, because what's happening in Iraq is there is one war between the US and its allies and the Sunni fundamentalist rebels. But that's on top of a deeper war between the US and Iran for control, not just of Iraq, but of Western Asia. And on the second matter, the Iranians are winning. The US is handing Iraq to the Iranians by the strategy it's adopted. The US, as it tries to draw down its own troops or leave, has got two policies. One, to train up Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi army, and the second, to organize elections, which lead to the establishment of civilian government in Iraq. But both those paths strengthen the hand of Iran, because most of the people who go into security services and most of the militias operating with the US are Iranian controlled. And secondly, the elections are producing an electoral victory, quite properly, for pro-Iranian parties. In other words, everything the US does to get out of Iraq is strengthening the Iranian hand. So the real occupying power in Iraq is not the US, it's Iran. And that's beneath and much more important than the war between the guerrillas and the US. And it links up with the fact the Iranians now have an important influence in Lebanon through Hezbollah, who've actually entered the government there. And now, of course, the Hamas victory has produced an Iranian ally on Israel's doorstep. The US and Israel are losing this big battle, and that is the issue. This is, if you like, the red-hot poker that's poking the US over the nuclear question.
Professor Fred Halliday from the London School of Economics. Thanks to Angus Kingston, who was the sound engineer for this programme, and to you for listening to Rear Vision here on ABC Radio National with me, Annabel Quince.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.